Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Moving on to Spider-Man Homecoming. Joe, I'll turn the question back around.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I was entertained. I liked Spider-Man quite a bit. And I'd been hoping for a really good Spider-Man movie ever since Marvel got to actually get their hands on it to do it themselves. And I was not let down. It was everything I've come to expect and hope for from a Marvel movie. I'm not going to say it's one of the greatest superhero movies ever made, but it was a very, very solid example of the genre, and it was one of the best Spider-Man movies that we've gotten in the past decade.
Oh, yeah. All the comparisons that get made are to Spider-Man 2, which is to say that this is a great Spider-Man movie. And, you know, Spider-Man 2 was of its era, but all the rest of them in some way or shape disappointed. It's either the best, one of the best second grade Marvel movies, or it's a top grade Marvel movie for me. And I waffle a little bit, but I really enjoyed it. I think thematically it doesn't quite flag what it's trying to say well enough, but from start to end, it's just entertaining as hell.
Thoroughly entertaining. And again, I'm always curious, how is a movie going to start? I don't know if I'm paying enough attention to story these days that just stands out as an immediate question for me, but that's always what I'm looking for, is how is it going to start? How is it going to draw me in? And the way this one opened, immediately picking up the threads from previous Marvel movies, I loved. You know, it's interesting. Neither my sister nor my brother-in-law were even aware that a new Spider-Man movie was coming out until I mentioned it to them. So you feel like the Marvel advertising machine is omnipresent, and yet somehow both of them managed to miss it. So I think that says something good about culture. But my sister, when she was visiting, I said, hey, let's watch just this 20-minute sequence from Captain America Civil War, where Spider-Man is present in the movie, so that you at least get a feel for who the character is. Because one thing she was excited about was when I told her this was not going to be another version of the Spider-Man origin story. It wasn't going to retell Peter Parker getting bit by the radioactive spider and watching his uncle die. You know, she did not want to see another version of that. She'd already seen enough versions of that. She wanted something new.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thrilled, and she was thrilled that that was not what this movie was going to be. And so I showed her the 20 minutes from Civil War that involved Spider-Man, and then she went with me to the theater to see the movie.
Cool.
And we were both immediately glad that I'd shown her the clip from Civil War, because it picked up right where the first Avengers movie left off and where Civil War left off, that honestly, I think you could enjoy Spider-Man Homecoming just fine without having seen either of the previous two movies. But I think it picks up those threads well enough that you're immediately rewarded for having seen those previous movies, and you're definitely getting an element that you otherwise would not get and would not appreciate.
You're rewarded quite a bit for seeing previous movies in this film. There's a lot of fan-pleasing that goes on here, from the Captain America cameos, which were hilarious, to all of the to the Iron Man stuff, which isn't just him serving in the mentor role. I mean, if you're a fan of the Iron Man movies, and there's actually a pretty big development for Tony Stark at the end. And I wonder if they didn't just decide to kind of backtrack, because as recently as Civil War, the idea was that he and Pepper were on the outs, and nobody wanted to see that. you know, we wanted a happy ending. You know, kill him off if you must, but don't have him all of a sudden, you know, just lose all of that.
I felt like at the end of Civil War, we were in danger of having Tony Stark start hitting the bottle, and nobody wants that. So, yes, giving him something to live for in this movie, I thought was a positive development.
Sure. It's a fun idea, though, having, you know, these major characters' stories kind of continue in bits and pieces in further films, and that may be a way forward after you complete their big trilogies. You know, if you want to see what Captain America gets up to, then watch this film, because he's doing something in this one, and then so forth. That seems to me a very canny marketing move.
You could even do cameos off into the future. I mean, the comics have done enough storylines where Steve Rogers retires and hangs up the shield and someone else takes over Captain America. And I don't even, the way Marvel has done things so far, I don't even think it would be out of character for Steve Rogers to hang up the shield and yet still have a drop-in cameo in another film where somebody's doing 45 seconds of out at the bar drinking with Steve Rogers talking about a mission before you go on with the rest of the story. So I agree. I like what they've opened up of all of these characters having interrelated lives that weave together. And even if it's not their story, you can still get a very brief glimpse of who they are, where they're at.
Now, before we continue, you've put emphasis on how a movie starts, really coloring your, you know, things as they go forward, which of course is very true. For a number of us, and I think if a lot of people I know were listening, they would have said this out loud as they were listening to this podcast, but the movie began with the Marvel logo, because you can hear a little ditty start up, and it's a play on the original 1960s Spider-Man theme song from the cartoon. You can hear that, and then all of a sudden it jumped into the Civil War material. And at that point, you know, I smiled, and I didn't stop smiling to the end of the movie.
This was a movie made by people who were genuine Spider-Man fans, not just a movie made by a movie studio that desperately wanted to make something, anything, so that they wouldn't lose the license they'd paid for.
Absolutely. And points, and that's a really good sign, because there was a major shakeup of Marvel Studios a while back in which Ike Perlmutter and his sort of brain trust, which included Marvel Comics writers, were kind of shunted to the side, and Kevin Feige, I don't know how you pronounce it, but was given full control. Because Perlmutter is more than anything a penny pincher. And this is the guy, you know, this is the guy who would start arguing about whether Robert Downey Jr. was worth it. You know, the money they were paying him. I mean, just absolutely from start to finish. And in fact, from every story that's out there, you know, it's ridiculous what people at Marvel Comics have to put up with. There's like one bathroom for the floor, so they have to take shifts, you know, counting paperclips. This company with so much money. And so, but there was the question, you know, of whether Kevin Feige was going to do well, or whether it was the Marvel Brain Trust that was responsible for these movies that were so much in the spirit of the comics, but which took the best parts out of them and turned them into really good, compelling films. And it occurs to me that it's been a little while since that's happened. And if Spider-Man and Civil War and the like are any sign, then we have our answer and that we're in good hands going forward.
Yeah, Kevin definitely seems to know what he's doing. And if it was putting him in complete control that got Marvel to open up the pocketbooks enough to get Sony to allow Marvel to be involved in a Spider-Man movie, if putting him in charge was what it took to get that, then it was absolutely worth it. Because, you know, knowing that Spider-Man is a character that's been involved with the Avengers and that is a full lead Marvel character, it's been a little bit annoying to have him off in his own universe separated from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's really great to see him back with everyone else where he belongs as part of the team.
Sure.
Yes, he's a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, but when New York is in trouble, he's going to be there to help out.
Right. I don't feel the same way, just as a minor note, and the Pierce and big comic fans, of course, disagree, but I've actually preferred the X-Men in their own universe, and I kind of like the fact that Fox and Marvel are at loggerheads, because I've always thought that the whole, or not always, I won't be that ridiculous, you know, at some point I glommed on to this conflict between the idea that the world hates and fears people with superhuman powers, and yet they celebrate the Avengers constantly, And yet they also hate Spider-Man. you know, it doesn't really all work in the same universe, and there's a lot more you can do if you just leave the X-Men out in their own world.
But no, I've definitely read enough comics lately to have seen comics where the X-Men are working with the rest of the Avengers, and I think even in comic book form, that feels weird. Mm-hmm. The X-Men feel like their own thing that should be distinct from everyone else, and it's always felt odd whenever they've interacted with others, because it's like the two worlds don't quite align with each other. And so there's some kind of a grinding, scraping sound whenever they try to write stories that involve both sets of characters.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, as with anything else, you know, some good stories have been written, but, you know, were they even necessary? Anyway, but to the movie itself, instead of all this meta stuff, part of the reason the movie was... we mentioned not killing Uncle Ben again, and I think that was indeed a wise choice. You know, you don't need to... The story of Uncle Ben was told in the original origin story, and not just what happened, but, you know, its effect on Spider-Man, this whole push and pull between guilt and responsibility for not doing enough, you know? Or rather, this idea that he could do more, and if he doesn't do more, then someone will die, and Uncle Ben bringing that home, and being compelled to do that. And that's fine. But you can also have a different character arc, because he's going to learn other lessons in life. And whether or not the people know about Uncle Ben and that lesson doesn't really matter, so long as you have them engaged in the conflict he's having now. That conflict being his desire to be a big-time superhero versus Tony Stark's desire for him to essentially grow up first.
Can't you just be a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man?
Right, exactly. That was the big idea. And I feel like it's not as strongly connected as it should be. Because if you ask yourself, why did Peter Parker turn down Tony Stark's offer at the end of the film, you can't point to a moment where he decided to do that, where he changed his perspective. This is essentially what he's been waiting for the entire film. And
I think the through line of the movie, I think I'm going to contradict you a little bit. I felt
How
like the
dare
through line
you?
Of the movie, I know.
I'm going to crush you like an ant, Joe. This is it. You're about to be humiliated in front of like half a dozen people. I hope you're happy.
Have you ever tried to actually crush an ant? Those buggers are surprisingly hard to get a good enough grip on to crush.
Sometimes they
I plan
bite.
To be the same way. I think the through line of the movie was Peter had to learn how to be comfortable in his own skin. He had to learn who he was. We see him in Civil War, and he's blown away by meeting Tony Stark. He's totally geeking out over meeting all of the Avengers. And that's picked up with right at the beginning of this movie with his selfie video journal that he's making as he goes to Germany, as he's in Germany, hilariously in the hotel room, putting on his suit, getting ready to go out for action. He's just geeking out over meeting everybody, and he's got these powers. He wants to be a member of the cool club. He wants to be part of the gang, and we pick that up. It's at the beginning of Spider-Man. We're moving full forward with that. He wants to be part of the gang. He wants to be part of the cool kids. He's ready to ditch high school. He's ready to ditch his friends. Let's move to upstate New York. Give me a room in the Avengers facility. Let's do it. And by the end of the movie, he's learned to be okay with who he is. Peter Parker, a high school student, living with Aunt May, with high school friends. And I felt like that was the through line of the movie, going straight through Tony taking the suit away and Peter saying, I'm nothing without the suit, because that has been his attitude all the way up until this point. Being Spider-Man makes me cool. And once he's lost the suit, he has to adjust to just being Peter Parker, taking care of his friends and being engaged where he is. And so I don't feel like there's any big turning point pivot, but it feels to me like a very natural progression that he has to be a little bit humbled in order to be comfortable with who he is He's not one of the cool kids. I don't think I've ever felt that with Spider-Man's shtick. He's always felt a little bit like an awkward nerd. And by the end of the movie, he gets comfortable in that role.
I mostly agree with what you've said there. I think I have an almost parallel take on that. My problem is that I think to some degree you have to be reading into the movie, because in order to kind of pull out a character arc, and you need to flag these developments, there kind of have to be waypoints. And maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just not, maybe I'm just too literal or something. But what you're suggesting to me is that his insecurity is essentially what's driving, about being Peter Parker instead of Spider-Man, is what's driving his desire to be with the Avengers. And that once he's content being Peter Parker, then it's no big deal anymore. And he feels that he can just go back. And I mean, I think you can get a coherent reading out of that film doing that, but so at that point, is it that he lifts the wreckage off of himself and beats the Vulture and then decides he's enough? I feel it was a little too ambiguous.
I feel the turning point, if we're going to identify one, is he's in Washington, D.C., but the only reason he's in Washington, D.C. is not to hang out with his friends and go to the competition, Nerd Bowl or whatever it was. Sorry, I've forgotten. He's not there. He's with them, but he's not there with them. He's there to do a mission as Spider-Man, and he's totally focused on being Spider-Man. And he gets... Sorry, I'm looking up a name. He gets Ned to hack into his suit and deactivate the training protocol. What did Tony call it? Babysitter protocol?
It's a girl. Then there's the babysitter protocol or whatever. Yeah,
which I thought was hilarious. Sure. I love that. I thought that was hilarious. Babysitter protocol. He gets Ned to turn that off and to activate all of the cool features of the suit. And we get, I don't know how many minutes of screen time, 10 to 20 minutes of screen time of him thoroughly enjoying having his own AI to talk to, and his suit is Iron Man style cool with all these special abilities.
And by the way, voiced by Jennifer Connelly, my childhood crush, and also married to Paul Bettany, who, of course, is the voice of Iron Man's AI turned vision.
That is a very cool connection. That is a very cool connection. Yeah, but he's nerding out over the suit. And then he realizes his friends are in danger. And we have this whole scene where he's scaling up the Washington Monument. He's frantically trying to break into the Washington Monument, which, having impenetrable bulletproof plexiglass or whatever it was also a very nice touch, because we're used to seeing superheroes just punch through the glass and go in the window.
Mm-hmm.
And him having to really work for it was awesome. But I think that's your turning point right there, when his friends' lives are in danger and he realizes he actually cares about his friends as individuals, not just as the part of the high school life that he wants to leave behind. And that seems to be what's affected him. He rescues them. He goes home. They're all disappointed that Peter hasn't been part of the team. He gets chewed out by the principal, gets put on indefinite suspension, and starts planning for actual homecoming. Because we're thinking Spider-Man Homecoming, this is just him coming home from Germany to New York. But it turns out the movie's actually going to pivot around the homecoming dance, that he actually gets up the nerve, not as Spider-Man, but as Peter Parker, to go ask her out and to actually take her to homecoming, not just as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. And he does end up having to duck out of homecoming, but I think that's your pivot right there, is him coming home from Washington, D.C. and learning to be Peter Parker and act like a high schooler, not just because he's biding his time until Tony calls him back, but because that's who he is.
Well, I think we're both close to it here, or rather not far apart from each other. I definitely think that Peter Parker being essentially grounded by Tony Stark, I think if with just a little flagging, I think that would have satisfied me entirely, because essentially, and this is odd for a movie these day and age, but the adults are right. Peter Parker is desperately unhappy because he's frustrated as Spider-Man. And once they tell him, look, you know, once they take that away, essentially, he's suddenly doing better. And he gets up the nerve to ask Lizzie to the dance, and he's there for his friends. And I think if Aunt May had asked how he was doing while he was studying homework or something, and he had had a moment of self-realization where he just says, you know, actually, I'm really good. that would have done it for me. Because I think that's what it's about. He needs to realize that he is happy being the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. And that's what the Vulture is supposed to reflect. He's the working man supervillain.
Yes.
Which was a really nice tie-in. And also, Miles more than the actual character in the comics ever got. The villain in the comics is just a really nice classic design by Steve Ditko that they haul out now and then, but there's never been a satisfying character attached to it. I don't know if the villain necessarily has a point to make to Spider-Man, because he's not trying to become better himself. You know, it's not a parallel motivation to my mind, but I think, in other words, we're both saying almost the same thing. Maybe a slight difference in how satisfied we are that the movie pulled it off, but I think we've both got the same idea.
Yeah. And let's turn our attention to Vulture, to Adrian Toomes. Mm-hmm. I really, really like that character. The blue-collar, working man's villain. I love that. We've got so many villains who are megalomaniacs, who want to take over the world, who want to rule the city, who want to have influence. Here's a guy who doesn't really want any of that. He's doing a cleanup job after the Avengers trash New York in the first Avengers movie. He's got a crew that he's wrangled this contract that's going to keep them all employed for a while. And suddenly these higher powers, these government officials that you can't even talk to, reason with, or barely approach, have come in and just snatched it all away from him and don't care that he's going to have to lay off employees and that they're going to be hurting a lot of people's lives. And his interest is, you know what? Screw them. I'm going to take care of my crew. And whether it's outside or inside of the law, these guys aren't playing fair. They're using the law to step on the little guy, and I'm not going to take it.
Yeah, it's a and very that's common complaint. Pretty, yeah.
And that's pretty much his motivation through the rest of the movie. Even when he's hijacking the Stark gear at the end of the movie, his primary motivation is we're running out of stuff we can sell on the streets. We need a new batch of stuff so that I can keep my crew employed. Now, obviously, there's a little bit of a hole in his morality when he's building stuff that's going to make life on the streets worse. But I really appreciate that his character arc isn't trying to rule New York City. It's just trying to keep his crew together and earn a living.
Yeah, it's fun. I was impressed by how they maintained this sympathetic motivation while still doing the whole executing a member of his crew thing, that he didn't realize that he was actually going to vaporize Herman Schultz.
I mean, he didn't seem all that bothered by it after it happened, sure. But yes, I love the fact that it wasn't a cold-blooded execution. It was, oops, I intended to punch him out. Too bad I killed him, but I did really just intend to punch him
out.
But
we are hardened criminals, and we're not going to be too upset about this. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. There's no... I mean, there are relatively few villains who even, who even want to rule something as opposed to the world. There's no doomsday device, I guess is what I'm saying. There's this whole trope that is so tiring. There's no object of power. that is in almost all of the Marvel movies, and that was really refreshing. And the design was cool.
To make it even better, there's multiple objects of power, but nobody cares about them as objects of power. They're just a means to an end of living a life as junk reclamators.
Exactly. Also, my will to not spoil myself paid dividends on multiple occasions in this film. But that also means the film did a good job of wrong-heading me, or of wrong-footing me. So I will say that I did not see coming his connection with Liz Allen.
Yeah, him being Liz's father, absolutely, I agree. I was as shocked as Peter Parker when Vulture opens the door and he suddenly recognizes his nemesis standing there welcoming him in. That was incredible. That was awesome. Right. I loved it.
It's the original twist in a way. You know, the whole Norman Osborn is my best friend's father thing was one of the big parts of the original comics. But it's done and it's actually pulled off as a shocker. So it's amazing how traditional this was, and yet they finally succeeded in making the old new again.
They did, and you know, in the original Spider-Man movies, they'd shown you the relationship right from the very beginning, mm-hmm. and so you knew, and you were supposed to have a sense of dread of this is going to be a thing eventually. Whereas this movie, they just spring it on you, and it was incredible. And you're semi-expecting an awkward prom meeting the parents kind of thing going on with him getting dropped off at the prom and with his nervous and socially uncertain as he's been the entire movie. You're keyed up to expect some kind of an awkward scene with the parents. And then to do that and to make it his nemesis was incredibly good. And then I never have notes in front of me, but had I been actually writing down notes, the note I would have written down at this point is finally an intelligent villain, because Adrian Toomes figures out who Peter Parker is during the drive from the house to the prom. And all of the signs are there. Spider-Man in New York, Spider-Man in DC, you know, it all fits together. And he actually puts the clues together, puts the pieces together, and is doing all of this awesome double entendre dialogue of you do the right thing or it's not going to go well with you. And it was just, I love that scene. I love that scene start to finish.
I didn't 100% buy it. I thought it was a little forced, but I mean, I still enjoyed the scene, and I was at this point, I had so much goodwill for the movie that I was totally willing to let it happen. And I will note that as a result, or just overall, one of the things that's so impressive about this well-written movie is that there are no really big plot holes, to my mind. Everything fits. All the twists make sense. We know why Spider-Man goes to location X to find him. You know, it's all very well done. And I was surprised that was another twist. The Vulture's big target at the end. The move, of course. Duh. You know? but I didn't think of it.
No, I didn't either. And maybe we're just both slow on the uptake, but the way they tied that together, Happy's been distracted throughout the entire movie because he's prepping for this move and he doesn't have time to talk to Peter. And then it turns out this move is the big thing. That was good. Tying Spider-Man into the broader world of the Avengers. We've seen in Civil War that they've got this facility in upstate New York. And so, of course, in Spider-Man, there's going to be a subplot about needing to move all of the stuff out of Avengers Tower.
Mm-hmm. Concerning plot twists, since we're checking them off, one other thing that I didn't expect was that, and it doesn't really matter, it's kind of funny, you know, the reveal at the end that Michelle goes by MJ is technically meaningless. All it really is a signpost that she's going to be a romantic interest, which we kind of already knew. And yet at the same time, it was a nice surprise. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. again, a movie made by fans for fans that rewards you for being a fan without clubbing you over the head with various elements of the Spider-Man universe.
Right. They're not stuck on the particulars, just on communicating what these particulars did at the time that they were created.
Right. And they're dropping it into the movie very casually. There isn't fanfares and spotlights and ta-da, look at us, aren't we so cute. It's mm-hmm. just there and it's fun.
This is actually not in my notes. This is only something I'm realizing as we talk about this. But really the great victory of this movie is that it manages the tricks that made people love Spider-Man in the first place by disguising them in new characters. In so many ways, it's so much of the set pieces or the arcs that Spider-Man has done before, but in new form so that they're not immediately recognizable.
Yes. And I will say, you know, endings are as important as beginnings. And I loved the very end of the movie that Aunt May walks in on him in the Spider-Man suit. And drops the F-bomb, wanting to know what's going on, and they just leave that as a cliffhanger, because now I'm dying to know, how did that conversation go in the next 5 or 10 minutes? That's a conversation I wanted to see, I want to see, and we will probably never see, it'll be left to the imagination. But that was just a fantastic way to end the movie.
It was, and that in itself, of course, it reminds us all of the... original Iron Man in the best possible way, but it yes. much more of a shocker for Peter Parker than Tony Stark, whose identity never really mattered that much, to be perfectly honest. It was a good idea to get rid of it in the first place.
So looping back, other elements of the movie that I love, just because I want to mention them because I love them so much, something that you saw coming from the very beginning was Ned saying that he wanted to be the man in the chair.
And then
getting to be the man in the chair, but it's the chair in the school library, which is what's absolutely fantastic about it. He's zipping back from computer workstation to workstation in the school library, which was, it was fantastic, but that part of the scene was really fun. And you knew as soon as he said he wanted to be the man in the chair, of course he's going to be the man in the chair at some later point in the movie.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a twist, but the payoff was just fun to watch.
It was so grounded, all of that, which of course is fitting, fits with the movie taking its cues from the Ultimate Spider-Man comic, which for my money has always been the best version of Spider-Man ever. That was what I was so excited to see, actually. Unfortunately, you know, this extremely interesting period of Spider-Man being in high school was actually fairly short in the original comics. You know, he graduates and then he goes to college within the first 100 issues in the 60s and early 70s, maybe. But it really works, Spider-Man as a kid. And his friends as kids.
It does. It does. So that was good. The other thing that stuck out in my mind that I loved was going to the party at Liz's house. Well, of course, her parents are out, so we're maintaining the surprise of who her parents are. But he's out in suburbia at the party, outside, seeing stuff going down a couple blocks away, trying to get over to it. And having these massive failures of transportation, because there's nothing around higher than two stories. There is nothing he can shoot the webs off of to sling himself through space. It's just straight up sprinting through yards and jumping onto cars. And that was, I love that. It re-emphasized more than anything else you could have done how much Spider-Man is a creature of the urban New York City environment.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a superhero for the urban environment. That is where he lives. That is where he's from. That is where he belongs, because he can move around there like no one's business. And you put him in suburbia and suddenly he looks lost and inept and a little bit goofy because he can't figure out how to do anything. And for a movie that's tying it to Peter Parker belongs in New York as its through line, that right near the beginning of the movie just wonderfully emphasized that.
That's a unique advantage of relaunches. You know, what they're doing there is they're doing a take off of an established idea. And yet it's the first movie in the series, you know, but having five Spider-Man movies already, you can play with that, even though you're in theory establishing the ground rules. In the Ultimate comic books, they did that as well. No examples are jumping into my head from Ultimate Spider-Man, but in Ultimate X-Men, Cyclops leaves the X-Men in number 4 and briefly joins Magneto. And of course, this is a big shocking moment for X-Men fans, but, you know, they haven't established anything that would rule this out. and they consistently did this. They would wrongfoot readers by playing on their preconceptions, even though these were new, because they kept thinking of these as the old characters. And
even though technically they're new characters.
Exactly. So there's this, actually, not to get too far off topic here, but there's this, you know, they're in every iteration of the X-Men, Cyclops and Jean and Wolverine are in this love triangle. And in Ultimate X-Men, Wolverine and Cyclops go off on a mission. And while they're out, Wolverine tries to murder him. just straight up, like, pushes him off a cliff or something. And like the reader, Cyclops had assumed he was in a love triangle with, you know, a reasonable person. But this was not true. He's a government assassin. He's killed lots of people. It was just great. But yeah, no, I loved all of those scenes. I loved all of the updates, really. And isn't that what a relaunch is supposed to be? It's when the pieces of a property get old. And are no longer necessarily as effective. And so you update them for the present day while keeping them in the same spirit. And in that vein, I loved all of the supporting characters. I thought it was hysterical that Flash Thompson is still Peter's bully, but he's a bully in Peter's sphere. He's one of the smart kids.
He's an intellectual bully. He's not a playground bully.
Yeah, that's great. I still think it's maybe a little too far into stereotype that he openly bullies Peter over the loudspeaker and stuff. I think that's not quite how humans work. Again, you know, that's a form of bully that is recognizable to bullies. But all of these characters, I was perfectly fine with. I really liked, you know, some people were mad about them being recast and not looking like the old versions, but I couldn't care. I thought Michelle was hilarious and charming and that she'll be a great love interest for Peter later. Liz was a sweetie. Ned was funny and Flash Thompson was great. I mean, all of them straight down the line.
Ned is everything you want in a nerdy friend. Ned was awesome. And I don't read enough of the comics to know if he's a longstanding character, if he's a new character. I don't care. He was good. I want to see more of him.
He's completely... Now, this is interesting, and you probably don't know this, but I will speak briefly about Ned. So, the character is completely different in the comics. In fact, he's like a reporter at the Daily Bugle, who turns out to be the Hobgoblin. So, anyway, he's an adult character. It's nothing like that. But the character of Ned Leeds in this film is 100% based on another character. So he's another character with Ned Leeds' name. And he is the nerdy friend of the new Black Spider-Man, the teenager, Miles Morales. Yes, exactly. Who actually is probably getting his own film. I think it's an animated film. I'm not sure. But people are wondering, like, oh, well, is he... I mean, the real character's name is Gank in the comics, which is like a Vietnamese nickname or whatever, because obviously he's Southeast Asian. But, like, okay, wait, they just completely ripped off Gank, but are they going to use Gank now in the other film? Like, what are they doing here? You know, the fans are curious. And on that, and on the note of Miles Morales, Donald Glover, in his cameo... Mm-hmm. His character is the man who turns into the burglar, the Prowler. And the Prowler is actually the uncle of Miles Morales.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so when he mentions briefly his nephew, he's talking about Miles.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Just more of those subtle drop-ins for fans. Another one of those things you don't need to hammer, but is fun when you realize it.
Yeah, I missed a few. I mean, I'll cop to it now. I didn't realize that that was who Donald Glover was playing at the time. And I also, it took me part of the movie before I realized that that Herman Skults, who I don't remember if he was actually even named, but the guy who, the henchman who was using the hand blasters was a nod to the Shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't quite latch onto that either, which is good. That's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic writing. I think the last thing I wanted to comment on was just Tony Stark in this movie. This movie well continued the Tony Stark arc that we've gotten from the three Iron Man movies and both Avengers movies and Captain America Civil War. Tony's arc has been trying to figure out how to deal with power, how to understand who he is and try to understand responsibility, and how to deal with all of that when he's affecting events on a global basis. And we've gotten through the past couple of movies this real, he does feel a sense of responsibility for everything that's happens. He feels a sense of needing to be more restrained and needing to be comfortable with being Tony Stark rather than Iron Man. And having that through line from all of the previous movies to now he's interacting with Peter Parker and he's trying to pass those lessons along to Peter Parker felt completely true to me. And I loved it because when he says, if you're nothing without the suit, then you shouldn't have it. We know he's not just talking about Peter Parker. He's talking about himself.
Right.
This was the lesson he learned in
the third one,
Iron Man 3, if he can't be Tony Stark, then he shouldn't have any of the suits. And here he is mentoring Peter, passing along that same lesson of you've got to be Peter before you can be Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it hilarious then at the end of the movie when he offers Peter a legit job in the Avengers and he's totally serious. And Peter's like, oh, this is a test. I just passed the test, didn't I? And Tony says, yeah, sure, kid. Absolutely. And then has to go face the horde of reporters with nothing to announce. Mm-hmm. That was just wonderful. Peter's learned the lesson that it took Tony the better part of 3 years or three movies and who knows how many years to learn.
Sure. And then, of course, classic Tony covers by proposing to his girlfriend.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there you go. There's an example of a jerk who is nevertheless so charming that you can't help but like him. And wasn't it nice to see Gwyneth Paltrow again?
I'd thought she was gone out of the movies entirely after the events of Civil War. I was glad to see her back. I don't know if it's a one-time thing or not, but I hope she's in more of them.
I really wonder what happened there. I didn't know if that was just a plot line they decided to not do, or whether... I figured that they just couldn't get her for any more movies, so they were phasing out the character.
Yeah, I thought there was some kind of contractual thing, and I don't know if I'm hallucinating a vague memory of that or if there really was some kind of story I saw a couple of years ago. I thought there was some kind of contractual thing that she didn't want to do anymore, but if she's changed her mind or if I'm just remembering that wrong, either way, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I really like her, despite the goop thing.
Yeah, she plays a far better character than perhaps she is in real life.
That's isn't that part of the magic of movies? This is why I rarely watch interviews or backstage takes or anything like that. I'm generally a little disappointed in the actors, and they're just so normal.
Yeah, I'd rather not be reminded of how completely average they are outside of their sphere of... sphere of genius. I'd rather think of her as Pepper Potts business genius than think of her as Gwyneth Paltrow, CEO of Goop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think once again this was a fairly easy movie to agree upon, and thank goodness for it. It's great to feel like a Spider-Man fan again.
it makes me really looking forward to the next two Avengers movies. You know, I have no idea how they're going to pull off this challenge of putting Spider-Man, Guardians of the Galaxies, and the entire Avengers cast into one really long movie split into two halves. On a professional level, that's a challenge I don't want to have, but I'm looking forward to the spectacle.
Well, I think that you can include even, not that they're going to, unfortunately, but I think you could even throw in the Defenders and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and everyone else. You just have to let go of the idea that everyone needs their moment. You know, I mean, there are that many characters in any normal movie. It's just the story's not about them. And I think the right way to approach in the Infinity Gauntlet series is to take a few characters and decide that these are the ones who are going to have character arcs, and that the rest will be supporting characters.
Yeah, that's true. You've always got the comms officer who's wandering around in the background, who maybe gets a line of dialogue and is there mostly as scenery. And it would somewhat hurt to see Coulson or somebody else in that role. But you're right. It's a big enough universe at this point that it almost makes more sense to have those minor characters as those background roles than to have somebody truly anonymous as those background roles.
And it can be deployed to great effect. You probably haven't seen it, but there was in 1985, maybe, there was a movie version of the Transformers, the cartoon series, released. You know, it was entirely animated because the cartoon was hot, and they were doing Transformers, and it was going to be followed by G.I. Joe, which was already in production, and also maybe My Little Pony. And Transformers did so terribly that the other two were immediately direct-to-video. But the movie is kind of a hallmark, in part because it was one of America's first introductions to anime, because they got it really detailed. You know, it was a very kind of Japanese style. But there were already so many Transformers because it was because they wanted to market so many toys. So, you know, every episode often had new Transformers and whatnot. And we as children were attached to these characters, you know. For us, they weren't ridiculous, you know, new obvious ad placements. But in this movie, this brutal movie, all of a sudden, instead of all the laser beams missing, they started hitting their marks. And we went from, you know, this fairly innocuous mime of war to the steep body count. And so you would seriously, like, there'd be, you know, the Transformers racing around trying to maintain the integrity of their defenses, and they'd step across the bodies of these burnt out husks of other Transformers that you'd seen in multiple episodes, and, you know, with no comment, because there's a war on. But, you know, four or five characters died in the first 5 minutes, and a lot of them didn't even have speaking lines, but you knew who they were. It was just, oh my god, you know, Wheeljacks, and it was brutal. They were robots, so they felt they could get away with it, but it was still, you know, arms being ripped off, heads being blown off, and just, it's stunning that that movie got made, and so much more wonderful for it.
This is why the other two movies were direct-to-video, because they so traumatized the original audience that
yeah.
They figured there wasn't much of an audience left for the remaining, especially for G.I. Joe. I mean, who wants to see half of the G.I. Joe crew biting it?
Oh, that would have been, yeah, there was no way, that, even though in the G.I. Joe cartoon, if you've ever seen any little bits and pieces, even though everyone has realistic-looking weapons, they shoot lasers for some reason, because bullets were too much for a cartoon show in the 1980s. But yeah, actually it led to a change, with the soundtrack notwithstanding, the leader clearly dies in the movie. But the dialogue acts as if they're taking away the body on a stretcher, and they're like, don't worry, we'll get him to a hospital. And then toward the end, while everyone's standing around, someone who appears to be off camera says, "Hey guys, I just heard from the hospital. Duke's okay." Really, he took that staff through the heart. He's all right.
'Tis merely a flesh wound.
But as kids, we bought it, of course, because yeah, we didn't know. So anyway, but yes, I think you know, just seeing someone like the Falcon or whatever go down without actually commenting on it, you know, is would be brutal, you know, in the actual Gauntlet movies. And when you watch, when you read the original comic, which I'm sure you will do before you watch the movie, it is actually something of a bloodbath.
I've been on the fence about whether or not to grab and read that comic. I keep having temptations to, and then I keep saying, no, I should try to surprise myself as much as possible. We'll see what ends up actually happening over the next year or so.
Mm-hmm. You've got plenty of time. They're still not far into it.
The way I was trying to avoid Star Wars spoilers until, oh, hey, Star Wars trailer at the beginning of the movie. I could have done without that.
Oh, yeah. I close my eyes and stick my fingers in my ears. And then I start rubbing my fingers around because that distorts the, you know, instead of it being just a dim sound, that actually distorts the sound. So, you know, I look ridiculous when there's a preview coming out of a movie I want to see.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well @AdamVolle. That's Adam, VOLLE.